skies for amber waves of grain.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we ordinarily would welcome your calls, but we're going to ask that you hold your calls for the time being, because we're hoping to have Andy Jacobson with us in just a few minutes, and she's written a fascinating book based upon her experience as a traveler. It was a little over a year ago when she was flying a plane cross country, and she noticed a number of Middle Eastern men looking very, very suspicious. Suddenly getting up, two or three at the time, standing in the middle of the aisle, talking, going back to the restroom together, and standing outside the restroom, and doing everything that they could to possibly get her, you know, give the impression that maybe, just maybe, they were hijackers who were going to hijack their plane. Well, Annie really became very, very concerned about this, mentioned this to the stewardesses, who were let her know in no uncertain terms that they were very concerned themselves, but there wasn't much they could do about it. After all, the men were there, they'd paid for their fare. But it was obvious that they were doing everything they could to attract attention to themselves. Well, Annie, of course, at that time, then went ahead, and her husband was there. One of the stewardesses asked her husband to very quietly to write down the description of the man sitting next to him, who was one of these Middle Eastern men. When the plane landed, why, they were met by the federal officials, who then questioned Annie very carefully for several hours about what she had experienced, and of course they questioned the men as well, the Middle Easterners, and then they let them go. And so Annie had written an article about it that appeared in a major newspaper, and was major magazine. It was picked up and created quite a stir across the country. And immediately then the government countered and said none of this was true. Now Annie has been told by a number of airline marshals off the record that this has happened on a number of flights, that the Islamic people in this country, as small cells of them, are probing to see how far they can get, practicing going ahead and building a bomb in the restroom there. And this is a standard, but everything was done by the government to discredit her story, not to let the American people know that this sort of thing is going on right here in the United States. Well, you don't want to hear the story from me. You're going to really appreciate hearing it much more from Annie. So, Annie Jacobson, thank you so much for being with us. Annie, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. And what's the title of the book that you wrote?
It's called Terror in the Skies, Why 9/11 Could Happen Again.
Terror in the Skies, Why 9/11 Should Happen Again. Well, why don't you start telling your story here, and we've got to go to break, but let's get at least the background of this story.
Well, I was traveling with my family, my husband and young son, from Detroit to Los Angeles, and also on that flight were 14 Syrian men who acted in a way that I believe the plane was going to be hijacked.
All right, and there were 14 of them then.
There were 14. It was not a small group.
All right. And what would they do that drew your attention to them?
Well, when we were in the boarding area, they made themselves out to be a group of about five. Two carried musical instruments. They had their Middle Eastern passports out in front of them.
Hold that thought. We're going to be with back here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Well, I guess this evening, Annie Jacobson, we're telling about, or talking about her book, Terror in the Skies, Why 9/11 Could Happen Again. Why don't you go ahead and go on with the story?
Well, we boarded the plane, and as we were sitting next to what the man I call the leader, it became obvious as the other passengers were boarding that it was not just a group of five of these men, but in fact it was a much larger group. They all kind of checked in with the leader with little sort of signals, eyes and nods and winks. But the really unusual activity began once the plane was up in the air, the seatbelt light went off, and suddenly all the men were up, and they were moving about the cabin in what I perceived as an orchestrated way. One would go back to the plane, pass something off to another. That man would go into the bathroom, come out, pass something to another. It was very important to the men that they went into the bathroom consecutively. They needed to go in after one another, so much so that one of the men, the largest in the group, actually knocked over another passenger to make sure he went in after his friend. Things were so tense up there that my husband went up to speak to the flight attendant. She pulled him into the galley and says, "Sir, we are watching the men. We know what's going on. We're passing notes among us, and the pilot has been made aware." And then she revealed to my husband that there were federal air marshals on board. This became quite a controversy later. We can talk about that later, but, you know, revealing that there were marshals on board is a big no-no to the federal government.
Well, it's unusual because they only have marshals probably in about 10% of planes, is my understanding, and usually those are the ones flying out of Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Because they really don't care about the rest of us, but they certainly would want to protect those politicians. So, anyway, so the stewardesses tell your husband that they're concerned that there are air marshals on board, and then what else?
And that the pilot knows. And so then they involve my husband in the scenario here to get a bit more information on the men. One of the flight attendants brings my husband a Coke and kind of leans in and says, "You know, please take down a description of the man. If I do it, it'll be too obvious." Which my husband does, passes it back to her in a note. I mean, things were really tense.
I imagine you were scared to death, and I know I would have been scared to death if I'd been in your situation. Now, this was how long ago?
This was last summer.
All right, fine.
Also keep in mind, it's a 757, which means one single aisle going down the plane. And at any given point during this 4.5-hour flight, if you stand up or just simply turn around and look around, you realize that there are two or three groups of Middle Eastern men. Two or three men per group.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Annie Jacobson. Her book, Terror in the Skies, that 9/11 could happen again. But basically what had happened is there were a large number of apparently Syrian men there. They had foreign passports. They board the plane. There's obviously a leader of this group. They are doing everything they can. They are going back one after another to the bathroom, not letting anybody else in the way. They are always standing in the aisles, which is a very unusual sort of thing. Annie's husband talks to one of the stewardesses, who tells them that they're very concerned about it, that there are air marshals on board, that the pilot does know, that they're keeping a close eye on this, and then they even ask Annie's husband to write down a description of the man sitting next to him. And, you know, but any time you would get up and look around, you would always find either a group or several groups of these Middle Eastern men standing in the aisle somewhere up and down this plane. So pick up the story from there, Annie, please.
Well, we're about to land in Los Angeles. We're so close to the airport, you can see the swimming pools and the golf courses. The captain has given the final clearing that we're landing. Everybody is seated. Everybody's strapped in. And suddenly, seven of these men stand up at the same time. Four go to the front bathroom. Three go to the back bathroom, and very slowly they use the bathroom. One of them brings in a camera with him. One of them brings in a cell phone. The other guys are waiting for the bathroom right next to the emergency exit doing squat thrusts. They are speaking now in Arabic to the man who I call the leader. He was seated next to us. And as the last man comes out of the bathroom, he passes the leader. he makes a slashing motion across his neck, and he mouths the word, no. They sit down. The flight lands. We're met at the gate by dozens of federal and local law enforcement. Now that's where the tale gets even more tangled, if you can imagine.
Go right ahead. I'm waiting to hear what happened.
Okay. Well, we get off the plane, and, you know, I just want to get out of Dodge. My husband says, no, we saw a lot. We have a lot of information. It is our civic duty to give this information to the feds. So we go up, and we offer to give statements. They say, terrific. They pull us aside. We give 2.5 hours worth of sworn statements to the federal government, doing everything, you know, raising the right hand, taking the oath, this is the truth and nothing but. At this point, I'm expecting that these 14 Syrians are getting dragged off to Leavenworth, where, based on their behavior, I believe they belong. So imagine my surprise when I find out that the feds interviewed these guys for 5 minutes, interviewed two of them only, the two quote-unquote leaders who spoke English. The men say to the feds, look, we acted regrettably, we're sorry, but we have an important gig to get to, we are a musical band, and we have to go. And the feds let them go.
All right, so that might have been the end of it, but you wrote a story about this, and that then, of course, began to create all sorts of problems. Go ahead.
That's right. I wrote a story about it, and the story was published on the financial webzine I write for, Woman's Wall Street. And the story was picked up and circulated around the internet and by bloggers, and the next thing anybody knew, this thing was world news.
And I remember reading that at the time, yeah, and thinking, gee, that's an interesting story, never thinking I would one day be talking to you. So then, of course, there is a reaction from the government, isn't there?
There is a big reaction from the government, and the government's reaction is nothing happened. The government's reaction is, we investigated the men thoroughly, and they were musicians. Now, I knew this because I received an unsolicited call, very surprising, from the Federal Air Marshal Service, who got wind that I was writing a story about it and called me up to tell me not to. Not to tell me not to, but essentially they said, look, honey, we got it taken care of. These guys were legit. Go back to bed. And that's not what I did, and that's not what I felt. And in my first article, I went so far as to say, you know, if 19 terrorists could learn how to fly planes, couldn't 14 learn how to play musicians? And that really was incendiary to a lot of people. They felt that I was out of bounds suggesting such a thing. But I was told by the federal agents involved that they had trailed the men to the casino and watched them play. Or they didn't say they watched them play, they said they made sure they were playing. Well, later in the course of my investigation, while I was writing this book, I found out the feds did no such thing. All they did was question these guys for a few minutes, and they let them go. And so the great debate became me, I believe, became me telling the truth, you know, just sticking to the facts, same facts that were in my sworn statement to the FBI moments after the plane landed, against the feds, with all their power and persuasion, essentially just making up the investigation as they go along, you know, making up more details to make their quote-unquote investigation sound more credible.
But now, didn't they try to get publicity to counter you and to make you look like some sort of a hysterical individual?
They sure did. I mean, they gave interviews, you know, as anonymous sources at the FBI, saying that I was the cause of the problem on the plane. And in fact, it's interesting because one woman went on the record, a woman that runs the FBI media office down here in Los Angeles, a woman by the name of Kathy Veray, and I write about her in the book because she says to the media, now mind you, this is the same day that the 9/11 Commission report comes out, revealing all kinds of government failure. And there I am, little old me, you know, just a person on a flight, talking about almost identical failures. You know, having to do with, these guys were traveling on expired visas. You know, information not being shared from one department to the next. So I think the fact that it came out on the same day that the 9/11 Commission report came out just put the government on such a defensive mode. They did the thing that they can do best, which is discredit somebody.
Of course, what they do is they demonize them. They say they don't know what they're talking about. There are no records to verify any of this. But didn't actually certain people in the Air Marshal Service or other government officials and airline pilots really verify and confirm that this has actually happened not one time but many times?
Well, absolutely. And that's where it really started to get, the story started to get legs, which was I started to be contacted by flight attendants, pilots, federal air marshals, and not just any old pilots, mind you. I mean, I got a call from, for example, a pilot named Gary Betcher, who is now the president of CAPA, which is the association of pilots that represents 22,000 commercial airline pilots. So when this guy speaks, he speaks with authority. And what he said to me was, Annie, this is not an isolated incident. The terrorists are probing us all the time.
In other words, he contacted you. You didn't contact him.
You bet. I had people reaching out to me, realizing this woman is in a position that she has no idea. I mean, essentially, I was way over my head, which was the perfect position for me to be in because I was able to move forward without any kind of, you know, fear, in essence. I really didn't know how big the story was. And I just needed to say what a dangerous situation this was and how appalled I was that more wasn't done. So, you know, very, very, very interesting stuff. Very scary stuff because you find out from reading the book all these documented cases of probes happening on commercial airplanes. And you have the federal government, specifically the Federal Air Marshal Service, not wanting that information to get out.
Now, but some of the air marshals did come to you anonymously to let you know that this was not uncommon?
Absolutely. Now, remember, there's a big difference here between the rank-and-file air marshals, the guys who are actually up there sitting in the seats next to you, protecting you. Those guys are the ones that I'm in contact with. Then you have the management, the bureaucracy, the brass. Call them what you will. Call them pencil pushers. These are the guys with the desk jobs. These are the former Secret Service agents who are just making up the rules. These are the guys who I believe were putting the kibosh on probes, who did not want the information to go outside of the Federal Air Marshal Service. And it didn't, because when I received a call from the House Judiciary Committee a few weeks after the story went big, they called me up and they introduced themselves. They said, Annie, we're the House Judiciary Committee. We are the people who have oversight over everybody in this country who carries a badge. And they said, here's the problem. We're getting information from you, meaning me, not them, meaning the feds with the badges. And there began my dialogue with Congress, and what I did was I, with permission from my sources, the pilots, the flight attendants, the air marshals, I passed on the information that I had to Congress, to the House Judiciary Committee, and they have been investigating this situation and others for over a year now.
Well, I fear that with so many congressional investigations, if they come up with anything, pressure will be brought to bear to keep it silent in the name of course, national security, because we don't want Osama bin Laden to know what we know. But this is the sort of thing that happens all the time. Did you actually go back and testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, I don't fly, so everything I did over the telephone.
All right. And now, of course, did they actually hold hearings, and did they bring in any people from the government to give their side of the story?
Well, they did bring in an awful lot of people from the government, and I actually got some of those memos leaked to me, and you can read about them in the book. And these guys, you know, stood in front of Arlen Specter, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Chairman Sensenbrenner, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and completely fabricated things about me. I mean, it was unbelievable. Things that contradict my own testimony. Things like Annie Jacobson was the cause for alarm on that plane. It's just, you know, just simply not true. What's interesting that you said about things remaining in Congress because they're classified, the House Judiciary Committee sent a very scathing letter to the Federal Air Marshal Service asking point blank, are probes going on commercial airlines? Well, guess what the answer was?
I suppose no.
The answer was, sorry, it's classified.
Classified. We can't let you, who run the country, know what's going on because we wouldn't want Osama bin Laden to find out.
Exactly.
We'll be back here in just a moment. here with Andy Jacobson. Fascinating story, ladies and gentlemen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, Andy Jacobson. We're going to be talking about her book, Terror in the Sky. Is it Sky or Skies?
Skies.
Okay. And now, of course, one reason that apparently the airlines don't want this information out is they don't want people to be afraid to fly. Would that be a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. But, you know, interestingly, in my investigation, I felt the focus was a lot more on the federal government than on the airlines. I mean, the flight attendants have, you know, their hands are tied behind their backs. I mean, these guys have become my real unsung heroes. They do so much. They ask for so much training. You know that they are still trained to cooperate with hijackers?
Oh, I'm sure they are. In fact, they've done everything they could to block the pilots from being armed. They've done everything they could, you know, to prevent any of the normal things being done.
Absolutely.
That would actually protect us. And you have to ask yourself, why is that?
It's ludicrous. I mean, the arming pilots program is a terrific example, and I'm glad you brought it up, because so many people find that, you know, subject boring. Well, I find it fascinating. Here are men and women who are, you know, essentially the lives of the 200, 300 passengers on any given plane are put in their hands, and yet they can't be armed.
Well, I think the thing is that most of these people have been in the military. They've used weapons. They know how to use weapons. And what is even more incredible, you know, is that just about 2.5 months before the 9/11 attack, up to that point, some of the pilots did have weapons. They actually were allowed to take them on if it was all right with the with their airline. About 2.5 months before the attack, knowing an attack was coming, a directive went out from the FAA said that furthermore, or henceforth, no pilot will actually be allowed to carry a weapon. Now, I got that from a gentleman who heads one of the other airline pilot associations with about 5,000 members. So, I mean, obviously the government knew the attack was coming, and they intentionally disarmed all of our pilots. And you have to ask yourself, why would you do something that foolish unintentionally? So, for our listeners out there, if you honestly think that the government listens to what Congress says, Congress has passed two specific laws demanding that the airline pilots be allowed to be armed, and the FAA has done everything they could to block it, they've made it so difficult and so preposterous and so impossible. In other words, the only time you can have the gun out is when your door to your cockpit is locked.
Right.
Once you unlock the door, then you have to put your gun in the locked box. Now, that's the time when you need to have a gun.
Right.
That's when you're susceptible.
So, well, you know, also another detail that I find fascinating, because you are absolutely correct that the government has done, or certain arms of the government have done, so much to prevent pilots from being armed. They make the training area for this, it's like a 4-hour drive from a major city. It's way down in the deep desert of New Mexico. So if you even are willing to spend your own money to get there on your own time off, on top of it, you've got to get to this really remote situation just to be trained.
And when you realize this is true, that they've put every barrier in the way of our pilots on our planes being armed, if there really is a threat from terrorism in the skies, why would they do anything that foolish? These are not stupid people. Congress has told them what to do. Congress supposedly runs the country representing us. And for some reason, some strange reason, they've done everything they could, even to this very day, of blocking the ability of our pilots to be armed to protect us. We'll be back in just a moment with Annie Jacobson. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Annie Jacobson, and we're talking about her book, Terror in the Skies. It's a suspense publication, and we're going to be having an opportunity to actually interview Annie on several times on other stations and other programs. So basically, now they've had a congressional investigation. The federal government has come forward and said all sorts of untrue things about you and make it out that you're the bad person, and yet, of course, you've been told by air marshals and by people from work as pilots, this sort of thing goes on, but they don't want the American people to know. And what is your reason? Why do you think they don't want? Now, I could understand why the airlines wouldn't want the information out, but why would the government not want to get it out?
Well, I believe, and I write this in the book, that it's pretty specific to two different federal agencies, and that's the Federal Air Marshal Service and its parent agency, which is ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which was created after 9/11 specifically to deal with these kinds of incidents. The Federal Air Marshal Service, for a number of reasons, would not escalate any of these probing incidents above and beyond their own organization. Some of it had to do with the fact that FAMs, Federal Air Marshals, aren't trained to interview suspects. Here's a great quote that one of the FAMs gave me. He was involved in FAMs as Federal Air Marshal. One of the Federal Air Marshals was involved in a probing incident that he said made my incident look like Candyland. And he told me about it, and I tell you, you know, I couldn't write about it specifically because it would obviously finger point him.
And he would lose his job because he's not supposed to talk to you.
Absolutely. So we just leave it at Candyland. But he says there was absolutely no protocol for what to do in a situation like this. So there he is up in the air, and he almost shoots the guy, you know. He almost pulls his weapon out. And he says instead, you know, the plane lands, and he gets out, and he's following this guy up the jetway. And he said, what am I supposed to say to the guy? You know, I almost shot you. Now I want to interview you. And that's where the incidents began. Those were after the first test flights, essentially, with potential terror suspects. That was the reaction. Now, they've come a bit of a ways in terms of what they actually have FAM supervisors now interviewing terror suspects after flights. But these guys are ill-equipped. I mean, do you know that the federal agents that were interviewing my husband and I were taking notes on the back of an envelope?
Yeah, that sounds pretty inefficient. You would think that they might have a little tape recorder there.
One of them had to borrow a piece of paper from another agent to write these things down. I mean, and furthermore, the most important agents that were supposed to be at that flight are the ICE agents. They're the ones who are trained to look at the travel documents. Terror suspects, terrorists, notoriously travel with bogus travel documents. So when you have, you know, the proper agents there that can look at that, then there's an opportunity to detain suspects, not stepping on their, you know, civil rights and whatnot. In other words, if there's something wrong with their documentation, you can say, you know, we're going to have to keep you on immigration violations. Meanwhile, you get a little more opportunity to do some digging. Well, these 14 Syrians were traveling on expired visas, but the ICE agents weren't there, and no one noticed. Now, this was uncovered by MSNBC, who got involved with the story and had me on the show a lot, Joe Scarborough, and it was really some great investigative work that they were able to uncover that, and it really reflected poorly on the government.
Well, now, are you an investigative reporter? Did you just sort of fall into this whole thing by accident?
Well, I am now. I must say, I've spent a lot of time, and I've done some pretty good work, I must say. But before this all started, I wrote Business and Finance for Women's Wall Street. A few weeks before Flight 327, I had been in India. I was writing about the king's finances, one of the Maharaji's finances. And I was in a Muslim village right there on the border of Pakistan. And, you know, I like to say that because I think it indicates it's the best defense I can muster to some of the comments that I'm a racist or, you know, that I'm a sheltered housewife. It, you know, it's just simply not true. I travel the world and see lots of people. But the situation was alarmingly different.
Well, I can imagine why you'd be frightened and why the stewardess would be frightened. And I don't know about your husband, but if it had been me, I would have been frightened. And we're going to be back in just a moment with Annie. Then we're going to get a little bit into the recent report that's come out from the 911 Commission. Now, they put this together before. The government's done everything they could to block it, tried to put it out in censored form because we couldn't have Osama bin Laden know what was in that report. Now, of course, apparently it's come out again, and I've been trying to find it, but Annie's already read it, so we'll be talking about that when we get back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Andy Jacobson, her book, Terror in the Skies. And, of course, we're going to go a little in the background of this report. Now, everybody will remember the 911 Commission report that came out. Oh, what was it, about a year ago it came out?
Yes, it was mid-July.
All right, fine. And so, now, was that mid-July of this year or last year?
Of last year.
Because
2004.
I was on track of time. Anyway, then, of course, but there was part of that report that wasn't released. Why wasn't the part on the, you know, what the FAA knew ahead of time, wasn't that released? Why wasn't that released at that same time? Or was the government wanted to spend more time withholding it from the people?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with the latter. I think it's, you know, ridiculous to make these claims that they have to keep this information from the people. I think it's transparency that affects change. I think it's transparency and accountability that holds certain folks' feet to the fire, certainly the people who make these egregious errors. You know, and the same thing, the Inspector General's report came out about the CIA recently, and, you know, that was an abomination. The government, you know, the upper echelons of government don't want to look bad, and that is why they withhold these things, I believe. There's one interesting note in there that I thought was fascinating. Salman Rushdie, the author who had the fatwa on his head going back, you know, probably 15 years now, there was some credible intel that terrorists would try to take down a plane that he was on. I guess the way they saw it, it was two birds with one stone. And that was in the 9/11 report, and the government, you know, had to withhold that. It seems so silly.
Well, everybody knew it. We even came out, I think it was the 5th of September, that he subsequently had told people he'd gotten this information on the 5th of September, ordered it. He was in England at the time, but not to fly on any American or Canadian airliners. So, and that came out right after the 9/11 mm-hmm. Commission report. It was common knowledge, and you mean they kept that out of the 9/11
exactly.
Commission report because
exactly.
they didn't want Osama to learn about it?
I think sometimes that they kept a lot of stuff. Personally, I think that a lot of stuff is kept out so they can bury what they really don't want you to see.
No.
I mean, here was another detail. They said that women carrying knitting scissors could carry them on the plane provided they had knitting with them. Now, you could argue, well, that's a good thing. You don't want Osama bin Laden to know, or he might get the idea of, you know, having one of his operatives have you know, some knitting work along with the knitting needles. The thing is that these guys are so crafty. They are so far ahead of the game. I was reading some information from the 9/11 monograph on terrorist travel, and there was this one bit which really...
Hold that thought right there. We're going to just bring our other stations back on board, and then we'll talk about that. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about the 9/11 memorandum, and it's just been posted up on the internet now and under the National Archives. And I've been looking for it. Annie's found it. I haven't. I'm not very good at finding these things on the internet, but it's there. She says about the second thing down, called the 9/11 memorandum. This is what. You know, was recently, of course, released by the government after doing everything they could to suppress the information from the American people. And you pick up the story there. You were talking about the fact that one of the things that they didn't want the public to know, that it was all right to bring sewing needles onto the, for a woman to bring sewing scissors onto a plane as long as she had knitting with her. They were knitting scissors.
Right.
So if she had the knitting, it was all right to have the scissors. If they didn't have the knitting, then she couldn't have the scissors. And you were pointing that was a little absurd.
Well, I guess you could argue, well, you know, then the terrorists could be posing as, you know, knitters. But here's the thing. These guys are so far ahead of the game. In another one of the 9/11 monographs about terrorist travel, there's the transcript of a conversation that was intercepted between two terrorists communicating about when you want to come into the United States. And one terrorist says to the other, well, make sure you tell the brothers that especially if they've been out in the desert with their bare feet, to spend a lot of time applying balm to the heels of their feet so that it's not obvious that they've been walking in the desert and have cracks in their feet.
Barefoot, right.
Now that is some serious forward thinking on the part of those terrorists, that federal agents would examine them so closely that they would notice their feet. So to suggest that these guys are dumb enough to be able to learn something about sewing needles is absurd. It's not giving them the credit that they deserve.
All right. Well, what was really in this report that, was that they did not want the American people to know. This is in the memorandum now.
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, the thing that I took from it was that they didn't want the, the FAA had a lot of credible information that planes were a target and that terrorists wanted to use them to fly into landmarks.
And by landmarks, you mean fly into buildings?
Yes.
In other words, the FAA knew that they were planning on hijacking planes and crashing them into landmarks or
yes.
important buildings. So
yes, I mean, John Ashcroft was told not to fly on commercial planes. I think it was starting in July.
So this is a couple of months before the September 11th attack. John Ashcroft starts flying on chartered jets, which
yes.
we pay for. They know the attack is coming, but they don't tell the American people. They don't put any marshals on the plane. They take the weapons away from our pilots. They make it easier, actually, for the terrorists to get on the planes by lowering the requirements as far as the weapons and box cutters and all of those things, which at one time apparently they couldn't take on, and now suddenly they could. And you have to ask yourself, why would they have done
right.
that? It just doesn't make sense.
You're also forgetting one incredible tragedy, which is the information sharing neglect.
Okay, tell us about it.
The CIA had credible intelligence. They knew that two of these hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Mindahar, were terrorists. They knew where they were, part of an Al-Qaeda cell. They had tracked them all the way from Malaysia. And on August 23rd of 2001, 2.5 weeks before the attack, they decided to share the information with somebody else. They had been sitting on this information. Finally, they decided to share it. They share it with the INS. The INS pulls up the information and says, these guys are already in America. Well, they don't share the information with the FBI, and they don't share the information with the airlines. Had they shared the information with the airlines, they could have stopped Flight 77 from crashing into the Pentagon, because Nawaf Al-Hazmi, one of these two guys on the watch list, bought his airline ticket in his own name.
They even had their telephone number. In their own name, it was listed in the San Diego telephone book.
You bet. And they were also listed in Choice Point, the information gathering database that keeps track of your finances. Both of those guys could have been found through Choice Point.
But obviously they really didn't want to find them, maybe it was something else. I think what most Americans don't understand is we have 14 intelligence agencies, or at least we did have 14 intelligence agencies, and we had a military, Army, Air Force, Marine, Navy, NSA, DIA, CIA, FBI. There were 14 intelligence agencies, and they were all investigating the terrorists. But the thing is, they've never told the American people. They said, well, the FBI didn't know, but
exactly.
Which other intelligence agencies did know and did nothing?
Well, it's the communication sharing problem, and it was obviously a big problem before 9/11. And what I take issue with is that the government, makes all these claims that the Department of Homeland Security is now this incredibly efficient information sharing, fabulous organization. It simply isn't. I mean, you don't have to look much further than Katrina to figure that out.
What a tragedy it was. I mean, how could you do such a poor job unintentionally?
Absolutely. And, Flight 327, some people say to me, how can you be talking so much about this one flight at a time like this with Hurricane Katrina, for example? And the reason I think it's important to talk about it is because it's a very specific incident. And so it's easy to really pinpoint what went wrong in a very clear manner. And that's the tragedy. And I document it in the book, and I really encourage people to read it, because it shows time and time again the similarities between what happened at 9/11, the mistakes that were made, and how they were repeated on Flight 327.
All right. If you would like to put out the Spence telephone number, you can't mention price or anything, because this is be going on non-commercial stations, but you can certainly put out the telephone number where the book is available.
I'm afraid I don't know the telephone number.
Right, fine. But well, it's chair in the skies anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, in this day and age on the Internet, you know, you can Google anything. But it is Spence Publishing, S-P-E-N-C-E, Spence Publishing. And the tip for me is that if you do buy it from the publisher, it's 50% off.
All right, we're not supposed to talk about the price, but that's all right.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. Anyway, of course, Spence Publishing is a good company, and they put out some wonderful, wonderful books, and Thomas Spence, of course, is the publisher. Well, anyway, under the circumstances, why it's I think it's important that American people understand that you're told the government is on top of all of these things, and yet, of course, everything they do is to conceal from the American people what's really going on. It's almost as if they don't have any confidence in the American people's ability to make intelligent decisions.
You know, I agree with you. I agree with you about that. I think that they really, you know, my experience with the Federal Air Marshal Service was certainly belittling. And I found that fascinating, you know, and on one or two occasions I did have to pull out my Trump card and tell them that I do have a degree from Princeton and that, you know, hysterics and racism aren't part of the curriculum there.
Right. Well, now, of course, you said something about you didn't think that racial profiling would really do anything to help us. What was that about?
No, I didn't say that. What I said is that I don't think using the word or the term racial profiling helps. What
All right.
I think it should be called is behavior profiling All right. or passenger profiling.
All right.
El Al, which is the airline for Israel, has a terrific profiling system, passenger profiling system. And, you know, they have not had a plane go down in over 30 years. They're clearly a target.
And we've actually flown on El Al, and you really have a feeling of being very, very safe when you get on one of those planes, because the people who check you in and check your baggage are also the people that fly on the plane with you. And if they make a mistake, why, they're going to be in trouble, too. They're not simply checking your bags and sending you on your way. They're
point.
Right with you.
You know, do you know this? Are you familiar with the story of Richard Reed and El Al?
Why don't you go ahead and tell the story? Now, Richard Reed was the mad shoe bomber, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Richard Reed is the shoe bomber, now in prison. 5 months before Richard Reed took that American Airlines flight from Paris to Miami, the one he tried to blow up with explosives hidden in his shoe, he actually took an El Al flight from Amsterdam to Tel Aviv. Well, El Al security agents profiled him, and they didn't like his behavior. Keep in mind, he's not of Arab descent. He is a half Jamaican and half British. So, again, you know, not racial profiling here, just simply behavior profiling. They don't like his behavior. They give him a head-to-heel search, reveals nothing. They let him fly, but they seat him in the last seat in the plane, and they put an air marshal next to him for the flight. Nothing happens. Well, that was obviously a wise move by El Al, because that was before 9/11. Then 9/11 happens, and then a few months later, Richard Reed is on that Paris to Miami flight, the one he tries to blow up.
All right. Now, of course, you talked a little bit before we went on the air about this idea that perhaps these men were being trained, that these were the ones on your original flight, that they were trying to pretend or maybe even trying to build a bomb in the bathroom, because this had actually been done before, hadn't it?
Yes, it has. Ramzi Youssef, who tried to take down the World Trade Center the first time by setting off a truck bomb, this was his brainchild. The 9/11 attack actually was going to be the planes attack. It was something called the Bujinka plot. And Youssef concocted this plot with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the mastermind of the 9/11 plot. The plan was to blow up 11 or 12 passenger airplanes en route from Asia to America.
And actually, they did actually blow up one plane. Youssef did it. And how did he do that?
Well, it was a Philippine air flight, and he was testing his big mission, which was going to take place several weeks later, which is he already had all the operatives set up to do this spectacular 11 or 12, you know, simultaneous explosions. And what he did was he smuggled bomb parts, different components in different places on him. He had some hidden in his shoe. He had some in his dob kit. And he gets on the Philippine Air flight, and he assembles the bomb in the bathroom. And then he goes back to his seat, and he leaves the bomb under the seat, sets the timer for a bit later. He deplanes. And then on the next leg of the flight, the plane, the bomb blows up. It kills the man sitting in the seat where Yusof sat, but it doesn't take down the plane, mostly owing to the, you know, incredible maneuvering of that pilot, the man who was, you know, at the helm of that 747. He landed it on Okinawa Island.
And I think, actually, of course, if he'd been a couple of seats forward, why, he would have been over the central wing tank, but fortunately, he got the wrong seat, and otherwise he could have had a much more tragic ending.
You're right, and I'll tell you something that really gave me the chills when I read this. You know, terrorists love to travel under disguises, and of course, I believe that the 14 Syrians were posing as musicians and were not really musicians. On that flight, Ramzi Yusof was posing as a member of the Italian Parliament. He even had a passport doctored up with an Italian name.
Well, Ramzi Yusof was a very intelligent man. I think he was actually trained and had some time in school here. He was the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing. He was the mastermind behind the whole Bazinka plot. Fortunately, he was the thing was thwarted in the Philippines because he was going to kill the Pope. He was going to blow up 12 airplanes. But they had the plan, and part of Bazinka was actually to hijack planes in the United States and fly them into the Pentagon, into the into the White House, into the Transamerica building, into the Sears Tower, and to the World Trade Center. We actually have a email, something off the Internet, in June of 2001, 3 months before, this talking, it was on the Northwest Airlines website, and it talked all about Operation Bazinka. It was put up there under the name of Bill Gertz, who worked for the Washington Times. And when I've talked to Bill, he just doesn't remember writing that at all. He just sucks. He just plain forgot that he ever wrote that. But we actually have a copy of it that we got off the Internet on September 11th or September 12th. We pulled it down. But for some reason or other, Bill Gertz doesn't remember that. The government doesn't remember it. Nobody in government had ever heard of this Bazinka plot. Well, eventually, of course, when Christian Breitwiser testified before Congress in September 18th of 2002, she talked all about that. She was, of course, her husband was, I think, was in the South Tower where he died.
Wow.
But, you know, the thing is that it's very obvious that they knew this, and they've consistently lied to the American people. And Condoleezza Rice got up right after 9/11 and said, who would ever thought that they were going to, hijack a plane and crash into a building?
Right, who would have ever thought? Well, a lot of us would have thought that if you'd been doing your homework.
And, of course, how could she be, you know, she had read the presidential daily briefing August 6th that said Osama bin Laden planning to strike in America, and it goes on to talk about hijacking planes and looking at buildings in New York City. So they knew that this thing was coming down, and they did nothing to stop it. That's what's so frightening.
It is frightening, and I'm frightened by the fact that they continue to do very little when you have really tense situations like Flight 327, where it couldn't be more obvious that those men were doing something in the bathroom. You know, here's an interesting detail. I was contacted by a total of 9 passengers from Flight 327, one of whom was a woman who is a CPA here in Southern California. She contacted me after the thing became world news, and she said, Annie, my God, you missed an important detail. She says, I was so terrified on that flight about what happened and about what I saw that I sent an email to the Department of Homeland Security the minute the flight landed. Of course, she never got an email back. But what she told them and what she told me was that one of the men, the largest man in the group, who knocked over another passenger so that he could get into the bathroom directly after his colleague, came out of the bathroom smelling, stinking of toilet chemicals. And he sat back down next to her, and she said to me, he did not smell like toilet chemicals before he went to the bathroom, and afterwards he did. She said it was so alarming, all I could think of, what the heck was he doing in the toilet?
And, of course, your basic thought is that they were maybe practicing, they wanted to see what they could accomplish. This was sort of a trial run.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, it's fascinating how the toilet is involved. I mean, were they hiding something under the toilet? Was something going in the toilet? Were they putting, you know, components up under the toilet? But this guy came out of the bathroom, according to the CPA from Southern California, reeking of toilet chemicals.
And, of course, all these other people on the flight did contact you, but none of the others really said much of anything because it's a lot easier just to keep quiet, and then you don't get demonized and attacked and vilified.
You're right, and it's easier to have a few drinks and, you know, watch some movies, and God bless them. You know, I wish that's what I could have done, but I tell you, I pay attention to things. It's just in my nature, and it was, if you paid attention to what these men were doing, it would be almost impossible not to perceive a threat.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Our guest is Annie Jacobson, her book, Terror in the Skies, at its Spence Publishing House. That's Terror in the Skies, Spence Publishing House. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney, our guest is Annie Jacobson. And Annie, it's a fascinating story. Now, of course, here we are, so over a year, a little over a year later. Do you wish maybe you had just kept quiet and not said anything, or do you feel that you've done what you needed to do?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I am definitely one of those people who I absolutely enjoy life. I enjoy what comes down the pike, and it's always unexpected. And this is just what happened. And it's very interesting to be a conduit, in essence, for change. I mean, that's how I look at it, and that's why I don't get frustrated going up against the feds. Shortly after the flight landed, when I was really in the thick of getting a lot of you-know-what from the federal government, I got an interesting email, and I write about this in the book. It was from someone who worked at the Department of Homeland Security alongside of NORAD, and this woman was had enough chutzpah to actually sign her name, and she told me, she said, "I don't know if you believe in divine providence, but I believe you were on that flight for a reason so that you could write about it. Keep going." And when the going would get tough, I would have a peek at that email, and it would really, you know, it would really give me courage, and it would make me say, you know what, there's a bigger picture here, and I'm part of it, and whatever part I can do, as long as I stick to the facts, that's terrific.
Well, I'm glad that you were on that flight. I'm glad that you've stuck to the facts, and I do believe in divine providence. And, you know, I think that you were probably there for a very specific purpose, because if you hadn't been there, we never would have heard about this this sort of thing that's gone on. And then, of course, as we carry this over into so many other things, the fact that the marshals are not allowed to talk about this sort of thing, really the pilots aren't allowed to talk about it either, or at least if the pilot who was on that flight has never spoken, has he?
No, he hasn't. But I'll tell you another hopeful thing, and this came to me after the book went to publication. But the same pilot, Gary Betcher, who's president of CAPA, and he called me up right when the incident happened, and he said, "Incidents like this are happening all the time. The terrorists are probing us all the time." When I spoke to him a couple weeks ago, he told me that there have not been many incidents that he has heard of since this happened.
Well, I think the major thing is the fact that you brought it out, and suddenly they back off, because the last thing in the world they want is for alarmed and concerned American public.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't want another Flight 93.
Right. And so I think it's important that you do it, and of course we're looking forward to having you as a guest on a couple of our other programs, and I hope you'll come on.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening was Annie Jacobson. I hope you enjoyed her story, and I hope that you want to consider very seriously what she said. We're not getting the true story. We have not gotten the true story of what happened on September 11th, 2001. And, you know, there's so much material that we hope many of you want to go up onto our website. That's radioliberty.com, and pull down my newsletters. I've done a number of newsletters dealing with what happened on 9/11, and if you read them through, you can come to no other conclusion. that there were people who knew ahead of time exactly what was going to happen. Salman Rushdie was warned, certainly. John Ashcroft was warned. Mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, was warned. In fact, I personally checked that story out by talking to Mayor Willie Brown's press secretary, who confirmed the fact that the night before 911, Mayor Willie Brown was warned to be very careful flying the following day. What was even more interesting was the article that appeared on the early morning issue on the 12th of September in the San Francisco Chronicle suddenly disappeared from all subsequent editions. Suddenly disappeared off the internet and never to be heard from again. But of course, we've tried to keep that story alive, and any of you out there would like to see the article out of the San Francisco Chronicle, we have it published on the 12th of September, saying that the night before the 911 attack, why Mayor Willie Brown was warned. So this is an incredible, incredible story. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. If you'd like that article about Willie Brown, call us at 1-888-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and we'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. If you want to really understand who it is who runs the world and who it is that is behind the spiritual battle that's going on today, why we've written a book, we've written a newsletter called The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. And if you'd like a free copy of that, call us at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send it to you. Or if you have access to the internet, well, you can go up at radioliberty.com. It's the May and June newsletters, Occult Hierarchy Part 1, Occult Hierarchy Part 2. We give you the references to the books written by people who are part of the occult hierarchy. Or you can go up on the internet and Google in the occult hierarchy. And, of course, you'll see articles written by people who are part of the occult hierarchy, who are in touch with the masters of wisdom, with the great white brotherhood, with the people who really run the world. Now, who are these? Why, they're really demonic forces, of course, because we're involved in a spiritual battle. But there are people who are in contact with them, just as on NBC television, we see about the medium. She's in contact with them. Of course, they're not making any world-shaking decisions, but believe me, there are people who are. And you wonder why it is America is being drawn into World War III in the Middle East. There's an invisible force behind what's going on. Well, remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day on the internet. You can get our shortwave link-ups. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24 Liberty, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because and don't call in unless we specifically ask for calls. We have this evening Chris Simcox, and Chris has been involved with a group of concerned Americans who've been working down on the border. I think Chris, you call your group the Minutemen?
Yes, that's correct.
And of course, they're concerned about what's happening, but the fact that the government is steadfastly determined not to stop illegal immigrants and terrorists from coming in across our border. Now, that really doesn't make sense unless you understand that there is a much larger agenda behind what's going on, and that is the fact that our leaders of both political parties are dedicated to globalism, to the destruction of our national sovereignty, to the transfer of America's wealth to other countries throughout the world, to the impoverishment of our people, and to the destruction, basically, of the national sovereignty of this once great nation. So when you understand that, it all makes sense. And yet, for the average individual out there, and they see what's happening and the illegal immigrants coming into our country and everything being done to entice them to come in, the offers of free medical care, free education for their children, they can always get, you know, a subsidized education here in the state of California at the university level. Why would you do anything like that unintentionally? If they're picked up by police officers, why the police officer can't turn them over to INS? They're picked up by the INS. Why they're still, well, we're going to have a hearing in about a month. Well, you be sure to come back, and you know that probably 95% of those people who come in illegally don't bother to come back for the hearings. So, Chris, how did you get involved in this whole incredible scenario that, you know, is going on, and the American people just don't seem to care?
It started for me about a week after September 11th, the attacks of September 11th, when I decided to take a bit of a vacation from Los Angeles and ended up in a national park, Oregon Pipe National Park, on the border with Arizona and Mexico, and encountered hundreds of people entering this country just days after the attacks, along with truckloads full of drugs and contraband coming into the across our borders, and finding that the Border Patrol and park rangers had a pretty cavalier attitude about it, that and almost a dejected attitude that, look, they're just, you know, people coming to work and drug dealers, don't worry about them, stay out of their way, and they won't bother you, and there's nothing we can do because we have no support from Washington. And I just found that a bit disturbing.
No support from Washington, we have laws, and apparently people in Washington don't want to enforce those laws?
That's exactly it, and that bothers me more than anything, is that we have laws, we have a Congress who makes laws, and then refuses to enforce them. And when we talk about homeland security, you know, it doesn't start in the borders of other countries. It should start here on our borders. And I felt disturbed that our government and this mega bureaucracy we created, known as the Department of Homeland Security, was doing very little to secure, ensure our national security and enforce our public safety.
All right, well, I certainly share it, and I think that 95% of the American people, whether they be of Hispanic descent or certainly came from Europe, as my ancestors did, I think that everybody who loves America is concerned about the fact that there is an organized effort to destroy this country. The question is why, and who's really behind it, and what's going to happen. We're going to be back in just a moment with Chris Simcox, and, well, I think you'll find it a fascinating, fascinating program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Simcox of the A Minuteman Group. Their website, www.minuteman.com. HQ, that's one word, MinutemanHQ for headquarters.com. So, Chris, what did you do when you saw what was happening? Didn't make any sense to you, I'm sure, at that time. What did you decide to do on your own?
At that point, I did a three-month investigation of what was happening on our borders and decided that this was a way I could help my country by exposing this, the hypocrisy of our you know, government and administration at that time. And I bought a small-town newspaper and began writing about these issues. And I then, in October of 2002, formed the first Citizen Border Watch Group, a neighborhood watch group that assist Border Patrol, being extra eyes and ears, and literally, you know, taking seriously my civic duty, which is for us to pick up the slack in an effort to help our government, but also to expose our government's hypocrisy and to say to our elected officials, look, we demand that you take this issue seriously, or we're going to remove you from office and start hiring people who will work for America First.
All right. Now, of course, what part of the country do you ordinarily live in, and where was this newspaper that you bought?
I moved to Arizona from Los Angeles, California, where I was a school teacher for 13 years in the Los Angeles area. I ended up, by chance, in a small town, 1,500 people, in Tombstone, Arizona, and I saw an ad in the paper for a publisher, assistant editor for a newspaper, and 3 months later cashed in part of my retirement plan and bought it to begin writing about these issues and challenging the mainstream media to tell the truth about what was happening on our borders.
So what happened to the newspaper?
Still am editor of that newspaper. I'm in the process of selling it after almost 4 years at this point and moving into securing our borders full time and lobbying in Washington, D.C., and again, encouraging our elected officials, basically demanding that they do something to secure these borders.
But have you run into the fact that the Ford Foundation is funding so much of this whole movement for illegal immigration?
Well, the Open Borders movement is a powerful entity in this country. It's disturbing. It's disturbing when we have a president who makes agreements with the presidents of other countries that we're going to erase our borders and that the sovereignty of the United States is quickly being eroded away by globalist and multinational
corporations. Hold that thought right there, Chris. We'll be back in a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Simcox, and of course, he helped to organize the Minutemen that were down on the border, helping the Border Patrol do what the Border Patrol should be doing. But his comment was that it's very obvious that there is a globalist movement that really wants to do away with our borders, and we have a president who, you know, talks about his patriotism and love of country, but he's one of these, along with the leaders of the Democratic Party. It's not simply Republicans. It's bipartisan treason. They have a different agenda, but they don't tell the American people the truth, do they?
It seems that they don't, that they want to placate us. They would like us to send more emails, faxes, and make phone calls and demand that they do their jobs while they continue to go about their business as usual. What we need are massive political protest in this country, which is what the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps is all about, that we are putting boots on the ground. We have sent Washington, D.C. a clear message that we are willing to take up the charge of defending our borders, and we will not at all accept our government erasing our borders.
But, of course, they really don't want you to stop the illegal immigration. That's the truth of the matter. I mean, they pander, oh, my goodness, we're just spending $14 million to get a Predator airplane so we can watch them come across the border, and we're going to put a few more men down there. But the truth of the matter is, and you certainly recognize this, isn't this simply all verbiage? Isn't this simply all symbolism over substance, rhetoric over reality? And the reality is, they have no intention of defending our borders?
It seems they have no intention, and I just returned from Washington, D.C., working with Senator Kyle and Senator Cornyn on strengthening their so-called border security bill that they're going to introduce. It's still far too weak for us, and I will not accept it or back it at this point. And I think, again, this is a situation where they forced the hand of the American people. These public servants, which of course they hate to be called, but they are public servants, refuse to work for us and to secure our borders, we need to send them a clear message that we're not going to sit around and wait for them anymore. Nothing has garnered more attention in this nation than the 879 people that we put on that border last April. We're about to repeat that here starting October 1st with over 7,000 volunteers and growing.
Do you know my friend Glenn Spencer?
I do know Glenn, yes.
All right, fine. Well, he's certainly down there, and I know he's working towards the same goal as you are, perhaps from a little different approach. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand that most of this this effort for the illegal immigration, funding the illegal immigration organizations like LULAC and MALDAVE, is done through your tax money, through the Ford Foundation, which has tax-exempt money. And the Ford Foundation has been funding subversive activities for the better part of about 80 years. And if you doubt that, you need to read the book entitled Foundations, Their Power and Influence, the only congressional investigation ever allowed of what the great foundations were doing, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and they were all working to finance subversive activities and to destroy this country. But the Ford Foundation's on the front lines of this, and the fact that most people don't hear that is simply reflects the degree of control that exists over what's going on in America today. Well, Chris, you know, it sounds like you're getting a tremendous response from people. You're going to have 7,000 people on the border, and when's that going to be?
We'll begin October 1st with another full month-long, 24-hour-a-day observation of the border, boots on the ground, citizens sitting in lawn chairs with binoculars and cell phones, doing exactly what the president asked all Americans to do, to be vigilant, observant, and report suspicious activity to the proper authorities. Now, we know this goes way beyond the border and regaining our influence over our elected officials. And that, I think, is what they fear the most, is that we're actually becoming activists. The conservatives in this country, if you want to call us that, the fundamentalists, if you want to call us that, which is nothing more than fundamental based on what our Constitution allows us to do and the freedoms it gives us. Our elected officials took an oath of office to defend this country. They are selling us down the river, and we're not going to allow that to happen.
My understanding is that there was somebody who had a ranch down there who stopped a couple of illegal aliens and held them for an hour or so, and then gave them cookies and coffee or cookies and fruit juice, and they sued him, and they ended up getting the ranch because one of them said he got hit. What was that story all about?
Well, it's a story that's not been reported well in the media and has been misrepresented. But yes, there was a couple of gentlemen who worked for a rancher in Texas, detained a couple of illegals trespassing on his property, called Border Patrol, who, by the way, would not respond. They released them. These two illegals then claimed that they were abused and pistol whipped. Well, that was thrown out of court. Then we had the most anti-American, one of the most evil hate groups in this country, known as the Southern Poverty Law Center, who took the case, Morris Bees, and defended these illegals and ended up taking land away from this one individual in particular because he was in prison and had no one to defend his rights or his property. Of course, Morris Bees and the Southern Poverty Law Center now own that property, not the illegals, and it will be sold to pay for their attorney fees, basically.
And so basically, here's a couple of here come to this country illegally. They're apprehended by people who work for somebody then they give them cookies and fruit juice. They end up suing and taking away the property. Was the man who was in prison even there at the time when this all took place?
Yes. Of course, they were not the ones that chose to sue. They were backed by, again, these interests, such as the Ford Foundation, but in this case, the Southern Poverty Law Center, who and Morris Dees, who work towards, you know, destroying this country in many ways through something called diversity and equality. But of course, it is a sad day in this country when people who break the law then turn around to use the law to benefit to promote this illegal activity.
And the fact they ended up giving him cookies and fruit juice, and they still ended up suing.
Yes,
they were here illegally. Have they ever been deported from the country for violating our laws?
Actually, they were protected by our government and allowed to stay.
Protected by our government. Yeah. And what our listeners must understand is that there is an organized effort. They want a bilingual country. Back in 1988, Senator Hayakawa from California tried to get through a law through the Senate saying English would be the official language of this country. Well, the people who hate America, who want to merge with the rest of the world, really want a multicultural, multilingual society, so they effectively block that. And now, of course, many times when I call my local telephone company, the woman comes on with a little message in English and then another one in Spanish. On many of the airlines, you'll get your message in English, and then if you're flying down close to the border, you'll get a message in Spanish. The conscious effort to make this a bilingual country, why? That way you can have two separate races that you can play against one another. Article just this last week that in the Los Angeles Public Library they have sections where you can get books in Spanish and then you can get books in English. Why? Because it's all about this. And then, of course, the Mexican immigrants are being used in this whole scam. The trouble is, I don't think most Americans even know the scam is going on. Do you, Chris?
No, I don't. And it is a scam, and it's unacceptable. When it comes to the fact that, like you said, the immigrants, the illegals, are being used in this game to pit two groups against each other in this country. We need to wake up, and we see that happening across the country, and we hope this Minuteman movement is awakening the sleeping giant, we the people, to challenge our federal government to do its job and support the American way of life, which is our Constitution and Bill of Rights, first and foremost.
Are you thinking about running for Congress?
No, I'm not. However, the co-founder of the Minuteman Project that we held in April, Jim Gilchrist, is running for Congress in the 48th District and here in California. I believe I'm getting much more done by leading a large grassroots effort in this country, a political protest, to demand that the federal government do its job and work for we the people first.
And I agree with you totally. I think the first thing and most important thing is education. And of course, we get people educated, but what are they going to do? Well, we need people in Congress who know what's going on, but we've got so many people in Congress that mean well, that have no idea what this is all about and do not understand the spiritual forces which are energizing these wicked people who want to destroy America, that they go back and they become part of the problem. Well, tell me, how can people get in touch with you, your organization? And what do you do besides, every 6 months or so, go down and spend a month on the border?
Well, folks can contact us at MinutemanHQ.com and click on the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps. We need volunteers to participate in this political protest, which, like I said, has sent a shockwave through Washington, D.C. They realize we mean business. We need volunteers on both not only the southern border, but on the northern border. We must demand through activism that our borders be secured, and we must threaten to remove these public servants, these political elitists, from office in 06 and 08. And the message is, if you want my vote, secure our borders.
All right, that seems like a very, very good message. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you're out there in the listening audience. And you have a question or comment on this issue. Chris is on the front lines of this battle, trying to get the information out, trying to get people to realize that the administration has no intention of doing what's right. George Bush says he's going to seal the borders, and now he's going to spend $100, maybe $200 billion. We're going to rebuild New Orleans, this wicked city, better than it ever was before, but we don't have any money to defend our borders. I mean, we can certainly guard the borders over in Iraq, but we don't have any money to defend American borders. I mean, we've already spent between $300 and $400 billion on a war in Iraq because, of course, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Or, well, he was an evil man, or, well, we've got to establish democracy over there in Iraq, but we can't defend our borders here in America. What's wrong with this picture? Give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Chris Simcox. And, well, Chris, as you talk to people, do they understand that this is not simply the fact that we've got a lot of people, you know, in government who are inept or bungling idiots or that... Do they understand that this is part of a much bigger agenda, and that is, of course, globalization, a world government, a new world spirituality, and the destruction of America as we know it?
Many of the people that I speak with, such as here today in San Mateo and just south of San Francisco, I speak to groups all around the country, majority of whom make up those folks known as senior citizens, the great generation, who realize that this country is not at all what they fought for and sacrificed for. It's slipping away. Unfortunately, it's the youth, even my peer group, I'm in my mid-40s, that really don't care. It's all about apathy. It's about quality of life. And, you know, why buck the system if it's really not knocking on my door and bothering my way of life? It's a shame that apathy and... complacency is ruining this country while others are taking advantage of that. There are some that certainly are aware. We need to continue to educate. It's about education. And I travel around the country speaking to groups, hoping to, again, awaken the sleeping giant and to the fact that it's slipping away, and address this issue with my peer group and even working on college campuses and saying, do you want a country that will support your children and that your way of life in 20 years? You may not understand it now, but you need to wake up and realize that this is going to affect the United States of America.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think that the biggest thing is education. And to get people to understand that this is going to impact on their life. We've got Terry calling from Sun Valley, and again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. This is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And what we are seeing on our borders is simply one aspect of a much larger agenda. I would call it treason. Terry, how are you doing?
Well, fine, Dr. Stan. One of the things I was wondering, since the United States has joined and helped create the United Nations, and its charter said that you forswear all loyalties to anyone else, does your guest find that it's really impossible for many of the politicians to keep their oath as American politicians while we're still signed to the United Nations, which says you have to forswear allegiance to all others?
Well, I've never heard that you have to, everybody has to forswear loyalty to their own country. Where is that in the UN Charter?
There's a part, and being as when you sign the UN Charter, your oath to UN Charter takes precedence over, I think, all others that you, I guess...
But most people never signed the UN Charter. The UN Charter was signed initially by Stettinius and Alger Hiss, who wrote it,
right.
Not by the average individual.
Right. So I was wondering, if we're members, or our politicians are members...
Our politicians aren't members. It's simply they signed, as you know, the charter that was back in 1945. But you didn't undergo sovereignty. The last thing they wanted the American people to know at that time that this was planned to be a world government to destroy American sovereignty. So I don't believe that's in there. Could you tell me exactly where that is in the charter, where that is written out, Terry?
I'm looking for it right now.
Okay.
Okay, I have the charter of the UN with me right now.
All right. What does it say?
Okay, hold on a moment.
Well, why don't you find that out? And do you have any thoughts on this at all, Chris?
I think what's more disturbing is the fact that our government and our president recently...
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Chris Simcox, who's with the Minuteman Organization, co-founder of the Minuteman Organization. We have with us on the line that colleague from Sun Valley, Terry, who said that, of course, our politicians have all signed the United Nations Charter, which pledges that their allegiance is to the United Nations. And I said, I don't think any of our politicians living have signed the United Nations Charter, nor that the United Nations Charter requires our politicians to pledge allegiance to the United Nations rather than to our own form of government.
I think I misspoke on that.
Right. So, but I agree with you that we should not be in the United Nations because its purpose was formed to become the world government, and the average American doesn't know that.
So this is part of the Agenda 21, then?
Basically, it's so many things. It's part of the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It's part of Agenda 21. It's part of the Millennium Conference that was held there in 2000, and the meeting which is going on as we speak back in New York City, where they actually, this is Millennium Plus Five. But the average American doesn't understand the significance of what's going on back there as we speak, as they are planning the destruction of national sovereignty and the implementation of a global dictatorship under a ruling elite, who, of course, are the great corporations, the great foundations, the massive bureaucracy, the people who really rule the world. Definitely. Anything else, Terry?
No, I spoke to your... I got your email, and I do have the Reef Committee report. You need those pages.
Oh, fine. Thank you. I tried to call you a little earlier, and I will want to talk to you later on that. Hey, thank you so very much, Terry.
You're welcome, Doctor.
Terry?
Yes?
Hang on. I'm going to have my producer actually get your telephone number, just in case I misplaced it, okay?
Oh, all right.
All right, fine. Oh, all right. Okay, he has your number, so we're in good shape. Thanks so very much, Terry. God bless.
Thank you.
All right, we've got Roger calling from Allentown, and again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Our guest is Chris Simcox and Roger from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, thanks, gentlemen. And Chris, you mentioned the case having been poorly reported on, and do drop me and move on if you're not able to clarify details here. I don't expect you to necessarily know, but that would have been the case brought by the Southern Poverty Pimp Center with Morris Sleaze.
Go ahead. Just go into all the descriptions of.
Yeah, but I understand.
Let's just stick right with the issues, and rather than name calling.
Yeah,
because that's the sort of thing they would do. We would never want to stoop to that level, Roger.
Okay. I understand the two defendants, I believe, were named Casey Nethercott and Jack Foote, and that they didn't show for the trial, so they had a default judgment against them. Could you clarify that? And then I had a follow-on.
All right. So what was it that they were in jail so they couldn't show up? What was that about?
Yes, it was a clever ploy where Morris Dees took the case after realizing that neither person could defend themselves, one being in prison for 5 years for possessing a weapon after committing a felony, and the other also doing the same. So they were both, I guess in a sense, precluded from defending themselves because they were incarcerated, and thus they made easy prey to make a statement, more than anything, to terrorize landowners from allowing any citizen to assist them in protecting their property when the federal government won't.
All right, anything else, Roger?
So Casey had been convicted or not, and not just, I understand he was held on an unrelated charge.
Yes. He was not convicted for abusing the illegal aliens in any way. It was that he was caught on videotape by our federal government holding a weapon when he was prohibited from doing that after being convicted of a previous felony.
Okay. Anything else, Roger?
Then I understand that while Casey was in prison, he had somehow kicked out Jack Foote and then got a couple of skinhead types or something like that, some lesser individuals to take over the defense of the property or something?
It was a decline of what was once a very noble effort to help defend the property, Ranch Rescue, a group known for repairing property damage created by illegals and drug dealers, which declined into to a point where they attracted some unsavory people which led to their downfall.
Okay, thanks very much, Roger.
God bless.
Bye-bye. And our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I guess is Chris Simcox, and I think it's important for people to understand that there really is an effort to destroy the sovereignty of the United States. We're under attack today. You're not going to hear about this from the Rush Limbaugh. You're not going to hear about it from so many of the other commentators. Why? They're very, very well paid to argue back and forth, to put on a great show, to talk about all sorts of things, but never to tell you the important issues.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Chris Simcox, and we're talking about what's really going on the border. Chris has been down there, of course, trying to draw attention to what's going on and trying to help the Border Patrol. Now, as far as the Border Patrol, do you think that the average person working on the Border Patrol is trying to do a good job and simply kept from doing it by his superiors?
Yes. All of the Border Patrol agents, men and women, that I have interfaced with are great Americans. They're doing the best they can with what they have. They care about this country. They're absolutely dejected and demoralized at the lack of support they get from this administration as well as Congress. In fact, the attrition rate right now is unacceptable. But they're doing the best they can. They care. They consider this movement, this Minuteman movement and the citizen movement, they consider us heroes in bringing national attention to an issue that they can't complain about for fear of losing their jobs or for fear of retaliation by our federal government.
And I think what was so interesting is the president can put up initially $10 billion and then another $51 billion or $58 billion, for initial aid to the people down there, hit by Katrina. And now they're talking about rebuilding New Orleans. We're talking to, in the neighborhood of somewhere between $100 and $200 billion, but we just don't have enough money to defend our border. Ladies and gentlemen, don't believe that for 1 minute. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know. Now, when we talk about the people coming across the border, are most of the Mexicans, or some of them from Central America, how many of them would be from the Middle East or from other potentially terrorist countries?
There's an alarming number of people from all around the world who seem to know very well that our government is weak on border security. 1.15 million people were caught last year. Certainly 95% of them were from Mexico.
Now, how many were caught?
1.15 million.
1.15 million, okay.
Border Patrol agents will admit that at best they're catching 1 in 4, which means that approximately 3 million people entered this country last year. We don't know who they are, where they are, or what their intentions are.
Have you ever noticed, though, that many times when they do apprehend them, why then they let them go and tell them to come back for the hearing, and why they almost never come back for the hearing?
Yes, we have an absurd policy known as catch and release.
Why would they do that?
Well, because our government says, again, that they don't have the will, nor do they have the money or the manpower to deport people back to their country of origin. And, by the way, the countries from which these people originate from refuse to take them back.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Chris Simcox, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And we were just talking about the catch and release situation. Chris was saying that there were about 1.14, 1.15 million people caught last year. Now, there were probably, for everyone that was caught, there were three or four that got into the country. But of those 1.14 million that they did catch, what they do is they book them, and then they tell them they've got to come back in a couple of weeks or a month, for a hearing. And would you believe that these people are then released into the community, and even more than that, that they don't come back for that hearing? Now, why would you do anything that stupid unintentionally? And the truth of the matter is, it is all smoke and mirrors. They don't want the American people to realize they have no intention of trying to stop the illegal immigration onslaught. But they have to pretend that they're doing something. Oh, shucks, if we just had more money, why, we could do something about it. Well, you might ask George about all that money that his friends in Halliburton are getting. Of course, they're still paying Dick Cheney that deferred salary. They paid him for a couple of years after he became vice president. And what about Bechtel and Fluor and all of these international corporations are getting the no-bid contracts to rebuild Iraq, and now they're getting the no-bid contracts to rebuild Mississippi and New Orleans. Well, maybe we get a little money from them. Let's go to Catherine, who's calling from Maryland. Hi, Catherine. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure to speak to both of you. I wanted to ask Chris if he knows how many of the border guards were pulled away from our southern border to go to New Orleans.
Do you have any idea about that?
Yes, at this point, we know that over 200 search and rescue Border Patrol agents were pulled off of our southern border to assist with search and rescue for Hurricane.
I was afraid of that. Thank you.
Yes.
And, Chris, the thing that comes up, Chris, is Israel can build a big, long fence along their border with the Palestinians. Why can't we put a big, long fence along our border, you know, 20 feet high with, you know, Corsatina, this barbed wire on the top, and, you know, to protect our borders?
Well, we are seeing those walls being built now. The Department of Homeland Security, led by the Czar, Michael Chertoff, has expedited the removal of people from this country because of the pressure of the Minutemen Project and the pressure of we, the people, the citizens, demanding they do something. Certainly we're seeing more walls built, and we are seeing some movement. It's slow, it's frustrating, but they are paying attention now. They realize they must respond, because or they're going to be faced with thousands of U.S. citizens taking up charge of that border, whether they like it or not. There's nothing they can do to stop us.
Well, now, what about the people that they come across? Are any of them have weapons? Are any of them carrying drugs or other things?
Oh, clearly. Look, just this, a small group of U.S. citizens that participated in the Minuteman Project, and previous to that, the Civil Homeland Defense, we've assisted Border Patrol in locating over 6,000 people from 27 different countries that entered through just one county in Arizona in the last 4 years. Of those, over 300 had criminal convictions. We've assisted the Department of Homeland Security in stopping over 50,000 pounds of marijuana, 2 tons of cocaine, and almost half a ton of methamphetamines, along with numerous weapons. They want you to think these are poor migrant workers coming. Yes, the majority of them are. But when you talk about the numbers we're talking about, even 1% of them being a criminal element is a threat to public safety and national security.
And, of course, when the criminals come in, they get caught, then we have to pull them in prison, and then we have to pay a fantastic sum of money to keep them in prison, you know, here, and it's all our tax money that's going into it. Well, you know, what about Chinese? We've heard some rumors about Chinese coming into the country. Have you heard any rumors about that at all?
Well, those aren't rumors. I have videotape evidence of people from Taiwan, from Korea, and China being apprehended coming across our borders. Clearly, last year, of the 1.15 million, that represents people from over 70 different nations.
But it's not predominantly Chinese. What they're always putting out of these stories on the Internet to manipulate our emotions and frighten us to death. I got an email today from a fellow who I thought would have been smarter. And he said that 3/4 of the people coming across the border are Chinese, and they're all carrying, of course, potassium iodide. The inference being, of course, they know there's going to be a nuclear attack. Look to me like part of the planned disinformation that's putting out by our intelligence agencies to frighten the people to hear. Have you heard anything at all like that?
No, and clearly, working with Border Patrol and knowing this problem intimately and seeing it up close and personal, a majority of the people are from Mexico or Central or South America, but I can tell you that I have assisted Border Patrol in locating people from 27 different countries, including Russia, Poland, Kazakhstan, China, Korea, Taiwan, Haiti. The world does know that our borders are porous and that we are weak on border security, and they're coming to exploit that every day.
And would you blame them for doing it? If I was living in one of these other countries, I'd want to come to America where, you know, I could get free medical care, and I could get free education, and I could get a lot of money, and I could, you know, in fact, the way that's being set up, these illegals are even going to be able to get Social Security down the line paid to them when they go back to Mexico.
It's an attractive deal, yes.
I refuse to believe. It is incomprehensible for me to believe. It is impossible for me to believe that what's going on is going on because of stupidity in Washington, D.C. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I think they just think that the American people are so stupid we'll never be able to figure it out. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. America is under attack today. The troops are coming across from Mexico, predominantly, or from other countries south of the border. But, of course, the whole movement is being directed from Washington, D.C., and could not survive for 1 minute if it weren't the fact that the leaders of both political parties are dedicated to globalization. and the destruction of our national sovereignty. Well, as you talk to your people who work with you, Chris, to bring out this concept of globalization, this bigger agenda behind this whole thing, are you helping to get these people educated? Because you must have a lot of people on your support list.
Yes, we certainly realize that there can be no other explanation other than, of course, President Bush and Congress realize that this is part of the selling out of America, and I was going to refer earlier to these illegal treaties that have been signed, known as NAFTA, and now we repeated history with our Congress signing CAFTA, and the President putting his name on that. These are treaties that erase our borders. These are treaties where we promise other countries we will not militarize our border to in any way impede the flow of goods and commerce. And that means not militarizing our borders. That, to me, is a dereliction of duty, if not treason. We cleverly call them agreements rather than what they really are, which are illegal treaties being signed.
And, of course, what's really so interesting is that when they got CAFTA passed Congress, 90 to 95% of Americans were against CAFTA. I mean, the emails were running, 30 to 40 to 1, against CAFTA, against this being enacted. But the Bush administration threatened congressmen. They spent $50 billion, that's B-billion dollars, on bribes for the congressmen to give special things to their areas or special concessions to them or their districts to buy their votes. Well, we'd call that, corruption, but of course in Washington, D.C., they just call it politics. And the Bush administration did everything they could to get CAFTA through, and they didn't put that sort of pressure on to try to stop abortion in America, or to get something done about partial birth abortion, now that it's been declared, perfectly legal by our courts, or even to get through drilling up there in the Arctic Reserve so that we would have some more oil and the price of oil wouldn't continue skyrocketing. They wouldn't spend that sort of money, to try to protect the prices at the oil pump, but they'd spend $50 billion, which, of course, we don't have. We'll have to borrow, get CAFTA through because it's so important. Because it does, as Chris says, erase our borders, destroy our sovereignty, and eventually will mean the end of America as we know it. So the Bush administration has an entirely different agenda. In fact, for the most of you don't know, but the national deficit last year was not $400 billion, as you were told. It was $1.13 trillion. And if you look and see how much the national debt increased last year, it increased $1.13 trillion, but they can't tell the American people that they're spending us into oblivion. The national debt is almost $8 trillion now. In fact, the Bush administration last year increased the national debt more than it increased between 1789 and 1980. In other words, it almost took 200 million years, 201 million years, for us to accumulate $1 trillion in national debt. And I can remember Ronald Reagan saying, pointing a finger at Jimmy Carter and say, why you're responsible, why you ran up the national debt $200 billion in, in the 4 years you were in office. And then Ronald Reagan turned around and ran up the national debt $200 billion every year he was in office. But Ronald Reagan was a piker compared with our current administration. They ran up the national debt $1.13 trillion last year. If you want the figures, we've got them. But the most amazing thing is, first of all, nobody's ever told the American people, and with all that money they spent, they can't protect our borders. Or maybe they don't want to protect our borders. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Chris, what can our listeners do to help you?
Well, like I said, we need to send Washington, D.C. a clear message that we're not going to stand for it anymore. Listeners need to participate in this political protest. You can register for our October event, and also we continue these events on a large scale every 6 months, but we also continue them on a small scale in individual states throughout the year. But we're sending Washington a message. Go to MinutemanHQ.com. You can certainly, if you can't come to the border, you can learn how to organize a protest. We need to take up pitchforks and torches, and we need to march on the capitals. We need to march on Washington, D.C. We need to demand that our federal government do its job. And while we're demanding, we need to begin doing their job for them, which, like I said, has sent the biggest wake-up call to Washington, D.C. that they've received in many years.
But now you don't have any weapons when your people are down there. They're not armed, are they?
Well, the point is that we're law-abiding citizens, that we use the law in our favor. We are responsible, sane, and conscientious American citizens who realize that we're going to play by the rules to get what we want, and we obey every law of every state in which we work. Now, I cannot deny people or their constitutional right to keep and bear arms. However, I will make sure that all of them have the right intentions and that they are the most responsible law-abiding citizens we have. We do nothing but observe and report. Just by sitting in lawn chairs, we have sent a shockwave through Washington, D.C., and it's working.
Well, of course, you really need to have one of those units in every county all up and down the border. But, you know, of course, you think you've got, what, 7,000 or 8,000 people out for the October meeting?
Yes, in all four southern border states. We're also beginning our first northern border observation teams. We'll be covering portions of the border in 8 northern border states. So we've got border to border, 7,000-plus people. And we're also recruiting thousands of military veterans to serve their country again, many of whom feel they're still under oath. They're going to come out in their RVs, come out, give us a day on that border, 2 days, a week, and participate in one of the most powerful political protests that we've seen in this country in years.
All right, fine. Well, certainly I wish you well. I think it's a great thing. Do people have to sign up ahead of time and tell you that they're going to come?
Yes, they should do that. They should go to our website, MinutemanHQ.com. Click on Minuteman Civil Defense Corps. You'll see right there how to register. We do require that you submit to a criminal background check to make sure that we have folks who have integrity and the right idea in mind. And then we'll give you the locations of where you can come. We have an online training manual that you can download and learn all about how we work. And, again, we're the most tenacious American citizens alive at this point, but we're also the most law-abiding, and we know that through this peaceful protest, we will get what we want.
Well, now, are you getting any funding from any place? How do you manage to fund this movement and, you know, yourself now that you're not working?
Individual contributions, which you can donate through our website. All of those contributions go to, on-the-ground operations and advertising this event across the country. And, again, like I said, we need to put, as many people on the border as we can. I make my living off of a syndicated column. Of course, I take not a penny of donations. I'm not paid by the nonprofit corporation. This is all gratis, living off my savings and my speaking engagements. But we, the people, again, need to fund what the most effective grassroots movement in this country.
Well, I certainly commend you for what you're trying to accomplish. Now, any of the great foundations willing to pitch in and help what you're doing, any of the tax-exempt foundations on our side?
No, none so far. These are all individual contributions from, like I said, a grassroots effort around the country. I will not accept assistance from any foundation who I know is not really working in the best interest of our country. This is a We the People movement, individuals who realize that one by one we will make a difference. And we do see Washington, D.C. sitting up and taking notice. I know when I have congressmen and senators calling me every week asking for my advice on how to get this problem solved.
Now, what about the syndication? You mentioned you write a syndicated column. Where can people read your columns? What newspapers are there in? Is there any syndication, a big syndicate that carries that?
We're working on that now. We have a column in Human Events magazine on the East Coast.
Right.
We're looking at the Washington Times. We're about to cut a deal with them and hopefully expanding this across the country. And again, it's an education movement to educate Americans about how serious this issue is and that we cannot idly sit by and allow our federal government to tell us they know a better way when we know better than they do, and we must demand that they, again, secure our borders. We want to see the National Guard and the U.S. military on our border within the next 12 months.
Well, they're all over there in Iraq bringing freedom to the people of Iraq. That's what they're doing over there, or democracy, or, well, something or other. Maybe chaos. Be that as it may, you know, I think it's such an important thing that you're doing. I think that you have to focus attention on something, and hopefully that people will begin to understand that the immigration invasion is simply part of a much larger agenda to which the leaders of both political parties are dedicated, to the New World Order, to the New World Religion. We'll be back here in just a moment with Chris Simcox. Again, his website is www.MinutemanHQ.com. That's MinutemanHQ.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Simcox. And, Chris, we've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up this evening's program. And, you know, I do want to say that I admire you for having the courage and the determination and the love of country to do. Thank you.